You're listening to The Space Show with Andrew Rennie on 88.3 Southern FM. In April last year, I travelled to the Kennedy Space Center in Florida to attend a conference called by President Obama. Called America's Space Program for the 21st Century, the conference aimed to both explain the president's new plan for human spaceflight and to gather views on how that plan might best be achieved. I was just meters away from Barack Obama as he opened the conference. We have previously brought you the president's inspirational speech on the space show, so we won't repeat it here. Needless to say, it riffed up the conference's invited attendees, although some saw it also as an attempt by Obama to shore up flagging voter support in Florida. That was a view expressed to me privately by some of the invited participants. The conference now broke up into four parallel sessions. One of these was called Expanding Our Reach into the Solar System. The moderator was John Holdren, the director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy in Washington, D.C. There were three panelists who spoke before the discussion was opened to the floor. Moonwalker Buzz Aldrin attended this session. John Holdren introduces the first panelist, whose theme was a new exploration strategy.
I'll be introducing each speaker as we proceed. I'm going to start with Dr. Ed Crawley. Ed is a professor in the Department of Aeronautics and Astronautics at MIT. He has been the chairman of that department. He holds a number of chairs at MIT. He's Ford Professor of Engineering, as well as Professor of Aero and Astro and of Engineering Systems. He was a member of the 1993 Presidential Advisory Panel on the Space Station Redesign. He recently co-chaired the Committee of the National Research Council's review of the NASA Exploration Technology Development Program, and most recently he served as a member of the Review of Human Spaceflight Plans Committee, the Augustine Committee, about which one heard briefly from Norm Augustine earlier this afternoon. So, Ed, I wonder if you'd start us off with some discussion of the flexible path and how it relates to our plans going forward.
Thank you, John. I entitled this talk, which is based pretty directly on the findings of the Augustine panel, although there's a few additional editorial comments, a new exploration strategy. Because I think at the highest level, that's what the discussion that the president presented today is about. That this is not only a new place to go or a new way to get there, this is really a new strategy for exploring space. In the Augustine panel, we actually began in a remarkably coherent system engineering way about thinking about what the goals were for human exploration, that human exploration is a credible partner of science, that it develops technology both for space, for NASA, for other users of space, and for use on the Earth, that it produces economic development and industrial capability, and that, of course, exploration prepares for further exploration, that these are the tangible benefits. And then, of course, particularly in the policy environment, there are less tangible benefits. U.S. leadership of international ventures, the soft power that comes from leading international endeavors, engagement of the public, and particularly inspiration of the youth. Now, at this point, you're saying, why is he reading off these platitudes? Because this is more or less the list that we all acknowledge, and in fact, most of this is expressed in the Space Act of 58. Well, the reason we read that I'm spending time on this list of platitudes is that to have a sustainable space program, you actually should do these things. How's that for a revolutionary idea? Right? And in particular, I will quote the words from the letter of the three Apollo commanders that was distributed earlier this week, American heroes for whom I have the highest admiration. They said, Apollo inspired a generation of Americans. And it did. And I'm here along with the president as a result of that inspiration. But exploration is not about venerating the past. Exploration is about inspiring the leaders of the future. And the most important one of these that we found the most disconnect in the Augustine panel this summer with is the inspiration of youth. We found very few young people who were inspired about going back to the moon 50 years after we had been there. It was a tremendous accomplishment, and they've read about it in the history books. We actually applied these platitudes towards helping select a strategy, and we called them goals. You know, and I'll ask you the rhetorical question. Did the previous program inspire America's youth? Did the previous program engage the public? Did the previous program demonstrate effective leadership of international endeavors? Did the previous program stimulate economic development? Did the previous program develop new technologies for use by NASA, other users of space, and the general public? I ask these rhetorically, but these are important considerations that go directly to its sustainability, that we actually tried to craft a strategy that would do these things. And in, I think, a remarkable moment one evening this summer, this very diverse group of panelists from industry, from government, from academia, from science, from technology, all very quickly and unanimously endorsed this statement, that Mars really is the ultimate destination for human exploration of the inner solar system. That staying on Mars and extending human civilization within the solar system should be our goal. That this is difficult, it will require a lengthy commitment. We actually heard the president say that he hopes to see some of this happen in his lifetime. But it's a time to begin along this pathway. And that these goals, the goals expressed in the important policy documents that have been promulgated by both Republican and Democratic administrations that are central to the Space Act, should guide our exploration. Now, this sort of summarizes as best I can the thinking of the Augustine panel this summer. That we started off and said, well, we got all these questions. Should we do something with the ISS or retire it? Should we go to the moon or something like the flexible path or Mars? And very quickly, we actually arrived at the conclusion that we should not disregard the ISS, but embrace the ISS. That the ISS really is a laboratory that we can use. And I should say that this was not a panel of ISS huggers. This is a panel, many of whom were on record at one point or another as having said the ISS was perhaps not the greatest investment of NASA's 20 years of effort to build it. So this is sort of an only Nixon could go to China moment. You know, that these previous critics of the ISS said, now we can envision a strategy that engages the ISS and use it. And I'll come back to that for a moment. Okay, so then that leaves the moon, the flexible path, Mars. Well, the next conclusion is you can't go to Mars now. That we don't have the technology and we don't have the national treasury to do it and do it safely. So we then moved Mars off into the long-term goal, that we should move towards Mars, but we should not plan to go and land on the surface of Mars in the immediate future. And that left us with, after the ISS, these two intermediate pathways, going to the moon or going along the deep space part of the flexible path, exploring, going to Lagrange points, the asteroids, and so forth, as the president discussed earlier. Now, I'll ask you, if you were the president in 2035 and the administrator of NASA came to you and said, Mr. President, we have spent the last 10 years going to the moon. We have developed the capability to land on planetary bodies and to rove around and explore. But no American or no international partner has ever been more than 3.5 days away from the Earth. We're ready to go to Mars on a 900-day mission. That's not a credible explanation. On the other hand, if you'd been on the flexible path and you'd spent a decade or so exploring deep space, going to libration points and so forth, and asteroids and orbiting Mars, but had not since Buzz and Neil and the others were there, landed on a planetary surface, Would you say that we're ready to land on Mars? Also probably not. So in all likelihood, before we land on Mars, we'll have done some combination of both the deep space part of the flexible path and done some test flights to the moon. And the only real question is one of order or sequence. But these give us two types of capabilities. They teach us and they allow us to develop the operational competence to work on a planetary body and to work in deep space in away from the in the full radiation dose of deep space. So that leads us to this lower corner diagram. And when you do this, you realize the ISS actually can now play some new roles. The ISS can play the role not only of human physiological studies and so forth, but of things like experimentation and fuel transfer. It could actually even be an operational base for early missions. So what is the flexible path, as we discussed it in the Augustine report? It's a new strategy. It's to travel many places in the inner solar system, but initially not walk on the surface. There are over 100,000 bodies in the solar system inside of the radius of Jupiter. And by my count, you can only land on 4 or 5 or 6 of them. The moon, Mars, 2 of the Galilean moons of Jupiter, and maybe a few of the largest asteroids. All the rest of them you would visit by going near them and bumping into them or making samples of them or operating around them, much like you operate in the vicinity of the ISS. They either don't have the gravity to sustain a landing, you would just bounce off of them, or they're inhospitable enough, like Venus, that you would never venture down to the surface with humans. So the idea that we're going to explore the solar system by landing on things is actually more a rarity than the general rule. Most of the places we might want to go, you actually want to encounter, not land. And when you encounter, it creates a new opportunity for a synthesis of robotic and human exploration. You get near the body, you send out probes. You robotically capture samples. You bring them back for analysis. You operate telerobots on the surface. I hesitate to say this, but you basically enter a standard orbit, scan the surface, and send down a Class A probe. This is a strategy that is, as the name implies, flexible. It's enabled by capability, and it's guided by discovery. Now, if you sort of plot out where you might go in the inner solar system, it's interesting that the world sort of falls into about 3 bands. And the most important parameter here, as all the rocket scientists in the room know, is that the energy increment represented in delta V from low Earth orbit. And you notice there's a whole set of things, the Earth-Moon Lagrange points in lunar orbit or Sun Lagrange points near Earth objects in a Mars flyby, that are a relatively modest delta V increment from Earth orbit. And then there's the lunar surface, and then there's getting to the surface of Mars. And remember, the rocket equation is not linear, as I would say in one of my classes at MIT. It's highly nonlinear, so it's significantly harder to get 10 kilometers a second of delta V out of a system than 5. So it's actually the difficulty in moving to the more distant locations is underrepresented by this plot. So there's this set of things that if you could move around with about 5 or 6 kilometers a second of delta V, you could travel lots of places. And let's look at what they are. First, you would probably go to lunar orbit. Or, interestingly, we didn't put it in the report, but another alternative is geosynchronous orbit. It would have interesting service implications and, frankly, security implications if Americans could routinely travel to geosynchronous orbit. I would consider the orbital flight, this is Apollo 8, go to the moon and orbit it. That's a test flight. That basically says to the world, we could return to the moon anytime we chose. I'm not convinced that we need to win the race to the moon to be the first nation there the second time. We've been there. Well, some of us have been there, Buzz. Then we go to the Earth, Moon, the places, the Lagrange points, and I'll talk about those in a second. Then the near-Earth objects. And then in 2025 or 2028, the NASA administrator and the president can decide what the right, depending on what we've learned and what capabilities we have developed. We could go to the lunar surface. We could go to Mars flybys. There's some very nice missions that go to Mars and get a deceleration in the vicinity of Mars, spend some time there, get another acceleration off of Mars, come back so that you could actually operate in a flyby in the vicinity of Mars for a reasonable amount of time. And they all eventually end up with some sort of landing on the surface of the moon. So here are a sampling of the places you could go on the flexible path. So there are the destinations on the left-hand side. There are types of things that you could use to engage the public that you can see listed here. There are opportunities to do science in most of these places, and my other colleagues will speak about that. The big unknown about going to Mars, or going anywhere other than the surface of the moon, frankly, is the human adaptation to prolonged weightlessness, radiation, and psychological stress. And if you were to design a research program, you would design it in such a way that you did a couple of weeks of this, a couple of months of this, a half a year of this, a year of this, a couple of years of this, and steadily, like in a Gemini-like mode, build up the competence to do it. And if you read down the human research column, you see that, somewhat by coincidence, but luck favors the informed, the choice of these destinations causes a sequence of human exposure and human duration that allows us to develop the confidence for the length of missions necessary to go to Mars. This is actually a more interesting view. Now, I have to warn you that these are figures from the Augustine Report, which assumed a higher budgetary level than is in the president's current plan. But it gives you some sense. At the top is what would have happened if we had run out Constellation, invested in technology, and extended the ISS. And you can see that it causes a lunar landing to occur in the late 2020s with an additional, as Norm said, $60 billion of investment over and above the president's FY09 budget. If we do the flexible path, we get out of low Earth orbit by the early to mid-2020s, shortly after the ISS might wrap up. And there's a sequence, a steady cadence of trips to new places beyond the Earth-Moon system on an annual basis. And the reason why this sequence makes sense is really very simple, especially if you've ever been a project manager. There are essentially four big pieces that you have to develop in order to land on a planetary surface: a heavy lift vehicle, a capsule, a lander, and a surface infrastructure. If the first destination is the surface of anything, you have to build all four of those systems before you can go. If you use this deep space route to the flexible path, you can build the booster and the capsule and start going. So that, roughly speaking, in the 20s, you'd operate the deep space systems and build the planetary surface systems. So in the 30s, you could operate the planetary surface systems. So just to summarize, these are the things that are the benefits of the flexible path. It's a faster start. You get out of low Earth orbit sooner. You go to destinations humans have never been, inspiring America's youth. There's a regular cadence of exploration of new things. You are developing the deep space capability you need to go to Mars. There's an authentic synthesis of humans and robots. Opportunities for interesting science. You get this beneficial development profile. You have an opportunity to engage international partners in a new way. And it represents generational change. I think this is, in some sense, the most profound thing. This is a way that young people today would think about exploring. And it will engage them and make progress towards our ultimate goal.
That was Ed Crawley, a professor of aeronautics and astronautics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And he was speaking of the new United States space exploration strategy.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
On this evening's space show, we are at the Kennedy Space Center on Florida's Space Coast. The event is a conference about the American space program for the 21st century. But shush. The director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy in Washington is about to introduce the next speaker. That director is John Holdren.
I'm now going to turn to Dr. G. Scott Hubbard. He was the program manager of the Lunar Prospector mission and was the first Mars program director at NASA headquarters, successfully restructuring NASA's approach to Mars exploration after a number of failures. He is a past director of NASA's Ames Research Center and the NASA Astrobiology Institute, served as a member of the Columbia Accident Investigation Board. He's currently a professor at Stanford University, where he works on the study of both human and robotic exploration of space, as well as continued research in astrobiology. Dr. Hubbard.
Let me build on the excellent introduction by Ed Crawley. I want to talk primarily about robotic exploration and the beginnings of the true convergence of robotic and human exploration for both science, national interest, inspiration, return on investment, and the other platitudes that are nevertheless real objectives of the space program. And I want to say something that I haven't been allowed to say for a while, but under this new program I can say space exploration is human exploration. Sometimes, thank you. There were times when the twain never met, but now we're allowed to say what we're really doing. All humans are sometimes physically present, as Buzz was, but many times we send our robotic emissaries. Now, robots are terrific at the 3Ds, the dull, the dirty, the dangerous work, and they generally do what you tell them to do. Humans, however, we've got 2 million years of evolution in our current form, and our eye-brain-body combination gives us unmatched adaptability in an unstructured environment. And that's the key, because if you're going to a world you've never been to before, you need to be able to prepare to react to the unexpected. So consider all the science goals the National Academy has been looking at. Many of them can be very effectively and efficiently done without human intervention on the surface. However, there are a series of science goals where humans would be particularly, even exceptionally valuable, particularly picking out samples and making judgments about what science to do, how to react to being around another world or on the surface of another world. I think this budget advances both of those goals. I'm going to talk just a minute about what I think is the scientific heart of exploration. Astrobiology was a term invented for these purposes about 14 years ago now, almost 15. It only has three questions. Where did we come from? Are we alone? Where are we going? Easy questions, very tough to get the answers. But this synthesis, this multidisciplinary convergence of sciences seeks to find the answers to these questions by looking at things like, is an environment habitable by a living system? And what are the fingerprints of life out there in the solar system? So let me turn to Mars. Since Mars has been designated by all these studies groups as the ultimate goal, why Mars? Well, it's the most Earth-like of the planets, most likely to have had or even possibly have today life on it, and it's reachable every 26 months, unlike the outer planets. And the theme that we adopted in the restructuring over 10 years ago was follow the water. And why water? Because water is necessary for any life form as we know it, liquid water. And it is a common thread among science goals of living systems, the evolution of climate, the solid planet geology, and human exploration. So following the water provides us with the resources for putting humans on the surfaces of Mars in particular. So today's Mars exploration program, as Dr. Holdren said, was redefined about 10 years ago. I got the chance to take a nearly clean sheet of paper and put a new mission queue together, grounded in science, but also based on the availability of technology and programmatic constraints. And that mission queue ended up with Mars Global Surveyor, Mars Odyssey, the twin rovers, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, the Phoenix Scout, and coming next year, the Mars Science Laboratory. And these missions sought and seek to understand Mars as a system. So following the water, how have we done on that? Water is a key to life, climate, geology, and future human exploration. And here's how you explore a world. First, you look from orbit. As we said, in the flexible path, there will be orbital missions. Mars Odyssey, launched in 2001, found evidence for enormous amounts of water trapped in ice in the top 3 feet of the red planet, up to 50% or even more at the poles. But this is information from orbit. Is it really true? You need to get the ground measurement to convince yourself that really you're seeing what you think you're observing. The Phoenix mission, a few years later, went to the North Pole of Mars, found the ice, confirmed that by onboard chemical measurements. So now we know that if the moon is moist, Mars is soaking wet with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of tons of water ice at the surface, and probably, we hope, liquid water further beneath the surface where it's warmer. So let's take one other picture. Mars Global Surveyor, launched in 1996, showed on the right a Connecticut-sized part of Mars that had minerals, as seen from orbit, that are always associated, at least on Earth, with liquid water. But do we really know what we're looking at? The way we explore a world is first to make observations from orbit and then go to the surface and confirm that with ground truth. So the Mars rovers, these incredible machines, they're in their fifth year of operations. The warranty was only good for 90 days, and they're still working. You will see that what you were observing from orbit was a Connecticut-sized field of these little blueberry-type spheroids of a mineral that only exists from long contact with water. Plus, we also saw the ripples characteristic of moving water. So this is how we understand what's at Mars, how we're beginning to understand the evolution of Mars, and why Mars is such an appealing target for future exploration. So what's coming up next? This is the sequence of the family tree of rover. And then quite deliberately, in the restructuring of the program, went to a sort of small golf cart-sized rover, maybe 300 pounds or so, which has sent back an incredible array of postcards from Mars, which just happens to be the title of a book by the gentleman in the front row, Jim Bell here. And coming next is a metric ton on the surface of Mars, the Mars Science Laboratory, that this budget fully funds, that will take the most extraordinary analytical laboratory ever built for the surface of another world to Mars. It's an astrobiology instrument, and this rover will be capable of going tens of kilometers. It has radioisotope power, and it will land very precisely all technologies that are necessary to build toward the ultimate human exploration of Mars. So with all of these really capable rovers, with this investment in autonomous systems and systems that we drive from the Earth, why do we need humans there? What can they do the robots can't do? And rather than reading this to you, I'll just tell you the story. It's the story Steve Squires, who is here, not in this room, but at this event, tells. They were out doing a field test. Jim, were you there for this famous experiment? Okay, so out of field test, there was a technical problem. So Steve says to the assembled population of Mars experts, let's do a little examination here. I've got a stopwatch. We're standing out in the field or out in the desert. I want to start the stopwatch. I want you to find something that's interesting. Go pick it up. Tell me what it is. So, go. So here's Ron Greeley, famous expert of Mars. He looks around. He goes over, picks up a rock, breaks it over with his rock hammer, looks at it with his hand lens, and says, genocide. Click. Total elapsed time, 45 seconds. To do that same piece of analysis, current robotic technology takes hours, days. So again, having a human being there with all the expense it requires would bring us back an enormous amount of scientific data. But to get there, the challenges, as Ed Crawley said, are significant. There's affordability in both budgetary and human terms. There are the biomedical problems, and we have to have the technologies in place. So some of those, from my past role at NASA Ames Research Center, we did a great deal of work on intelligent systems and autonomous systems. I can say that the Information technology challenges are things like management of large data sets, autonomy and mobility, and then the human-machine interaction and the telepresence interface that was being spoken of a little while ago, the ability to orbit a body and operate with very quick light travel time, a rover on another world. So this is the picture. This is a different way of looking at the flexible path. It shows things we learn from the space station, the heavy lift possibilities, the expeditions to the near-Earth objects, the missions ultimately to Mars, and then down at the bottom, the robotic missions that may precede the human exploration, so-called precursor missions. I want to propose the possibility of one, a Mars sample return campaign. This would be the convergence of science, extraordinary science, the astrobiology community, and indeed, I believe the whole science community dealing with planetary exploration would agree that bringing back samples of Mars will tell us a huge amount about the evolution of that planet and about the potential, the biological potential for that planet. It is going to be an international mission, I would say, because of the complexities of sending a lander to the surface, sending a sample up to orbit, rendezvousing with the sample, returning to Earth, and it will also be a precursor to human exploration because it will give us measures of the soil, the toxicity. It will be an end-to-end demonstration of traveling all the way to the surface of another world like Mars and coming back. So what's the future for exploration? It's not as it has been for maybe 50 years, robots versus humans. It is humans and robots working together. And I think this is what the new program can bring to us, and this is what the new program will invest in. Thank you very much.
That was Scott Hubbard, Professor of Aeronautics and Astronautics at the Department of Astronautics and Aeronautics at Stanford University. And I'm sorry about the quality of that recording, but when someone's too close to the microphone, there's nothing much we can do. On this evening's Space Show, we have been attending the American Space Program for the 21st Century Conference at the Kennedy Space Center. Our theme has been expanding our reach into the solar system. We shall continue with this theme on our next program when we hear the views of former Hubble Repair astronaut John Grunsfeld, moonwalker Buzz Aldrin, NASA Deputy Administrator for Exploration Laurie Lishan, and Bill Nye, the science guy. With a series of programs was researched, written, and presented by Andrew Rennie. Previous programs in this series can be heard on the internet at www.southernfm.com.au/space. That's all lowercase, and Southern FM is one word, southernfm.com.au/space.
Online all the time at southernfm.com.au.